You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show this Thursday. How are you all keeping? I do hope you're very well indeed. And clocks go back this weekend. Let us not forget that. At least we've a public holiday on Monday. Those of us lucky to be off to try and get accustomed to it and acclimatised to it. It's difficult with kids, isn't it? Because you get them sort of locked into a sleep pattern and either it affects them in the evening or it affects them in the morning. But I suppose it's for the greater good. But it's going to be dark. This day next week, it'll be dark just after five, effectively. So we're right in the grip, the throes of winter. And it's not too long to Christmas either, dare I even say that. I have to say, because I want to mention our Christmas big Highland Radio bingo party night with a Christmas theme. It's in the Villa Rose Hotel, which I was in last weekend, a beautiful venue. It's in the Villa Rose Hotel Ballybuffet on the 29th of November. So if you're looking for a bit of fun to celebrate a special birthday, just get a group of friends together, or even a Christmas party night with a difference, it's the 29th of November. Keith Fletcher and Lee Gooch will be your hosts. Marty Friels providing the music, and there'll be loads of festive tunes because you're right at that point where all the Christmas songs start on the radio. Christmas cocktails, silly games, bingo mayhem, and €1,000 top cash prize up for grabs. I can just see sort of like a mixture of, you know, a few people there saying, I'll go to bingo for €1,000, playing bingo very sensibly, and others with Christmas trees on their heads, drinking Christmas cocktails. It'll be a good old mix anyway. You can get your tickets if you want through Eventbrite or at highlandradio.com. So that's the big Highland Bingo Party, Saturday, the 29th of November at the Villa Rose Hotel. Now, to some of your comments coming in so far this morning on the issue of the ATU education, etc. A caller says, while there is great apprenticeships available, employees are not given any support to take on the apprentice. We do not have the money to pay a full wage, and while training them, my own work is slowed down and suffers. Plus, I give a year of them and then they go. Does the minister have any plans to address this? And I'm sorry I didn't get to that, but that's actually maybe part of a broader conversation we could have. Because I'll tell you, experienced people taking on apprenticeships play a massive role. And of course, that requires their time. And there's no guarantee that they're going to be there once they feel they're qualified enough to move somewhere else, go to Australia or whatever. Interesting. Let's get to some of your comments in relation to the riots that have been in Dublin over the last two nights. I definitely won't be voting, and if polls are correct, neither will over half of the electorate. The campaign was lackluster, the debate's dull, and the limited choice is between a dyed-in-the-wool Marxist and a blue shirt. Sad to see, after 100 years of independence, that's all that Ireland has to offer. That's the presidential election, of course. Isn't it a government and state-sponsored media main priority to create fear amongst the people and diversions from their unpopular policies? The focus on rioters instead of the disastrous immigration policy and social upheaval is just one more classic tactic by the political elite to blame others for their failings. I think both stand, you know. I mean, I think there's an awful lot of conversation. More conversation now nationally. We've been talking about immigration policy on this show from the get-go. We were a space where people could respectfully have their point of views and not be accused of being racist because their views weren't racist. We've been talking about it for a long time now, but the conversation more broadly is happening, and you can see even political parties changing their language and their stance. In terms of creating fear amongst the people, that's not a criticism I've heard. I've heard more cover-up, more using different words to try and offset the alleged incident. There's an awful lot, if you're in the social media space, there's an awful lot of whipping up going on there by people who end up making money out of it. But anyway, a caller says, the people are going to take this country back. The government better accept this, and the Garda or the government will not stop this. The government wants the people fighting among themselves what they exactly want because of our government. Yeah, I mean, I take what you're saying. But I mean, the threat of a water cannon does seem to disperse these crowds really quite quickly, and they're already reducing over consecutive nights. So I don't know where this is going to come from. Are you talking about it politically or otherwise? But we shall see. You may well prove maybe proven to be right. I think politically is the only way anything like that's going to happen. Right, Cosgrove Centre in Letterkenny. You're invited to join them tomorrow. as they're raising much-needed funds towards supporting local cancer care and support organisations, ensuring they continue their incredible work. All donations through their GoFundMe will be entered into a draw to win a €100 luxury hamper. You better go to their socials, because there's no point me reading this link out, because it would make no sense. And on Friday the 24th of October, hosting a coffee morning across all three of their stores, and everyone's welcome to join them for a cup of coffee, a sweet treat and a chat, all while helping make a real difference in the community. So fair play to all at Cosgrove's in Letterkenny, Cosgrove Centre. So that tomorrow there's a fundraiser, and they're looking for you to donate with the chance of winning €100 luxury voucher. Check out their socials for the GoFundMe link. And also, there's a coffee morning across all three of their stores. Okay, so a good way to enjoy a cuppa and also support brilliant charities. Just to remind you of our contact details, if you want to get in touch with us, and a lot of you sometimes like to sit down and write out an email, which is great. We love that too. Comments at highlandradio.com. So as I say, if you're listening to the podcast or if you are listening to us overnight, feel free to email. We can pick that up and carry it into the next live show. If you want to give us a WhatsApp or a text for that matter, it's 086 60 25 000. And we do get WhatsApp voice notes as well, which we can play out on the radio for you. And I think that's useful, you know, because all of us have sort of different ways of communicating, and we're better at communicating maybe verbally than writing things out. That's perfectly fine. And we have that so we can accommodate everyone's point of view, because we have equal value for all people's points of view. And if you want to give us a call too today, it's Caroline and Katie taking your calls on 074 91 25,000. Just a couple of comments before we're joined by our next guests. Read the presidential election. Welcome back, Greg. Thank you very much indeed. Someone said to me recently that I only work 4 days a week, that I don't work Mondays, and I must have had a couple of consecutive Mondays off. I work every day. But anyway, it's good to be back. Re the presidential election. It is plain to see from the debates that Catherine Connolly has the intellectual ability, the critical analysis, skills and political integrity to take in this position. Unlike the other candidate, who has none of these skills, which I'm sure would be hotly contested by her supporters, and instead denigrates her opponent and relies on very dirty tactics. I would bet Heather Humphreys doesn't even know the word, a word of our national anthem, which seems a bit harsh, but listen, thanks for that. My son cut his hand and went to the GP to get it seen to, but was then sent to the ED instead. I think it's ridiculous that people are being sent there with it being so busy and for procedures that could easily be done by the GP. Indeed, I remember going to the community hospital in Donegal Town and getting stitches rather than having to, I was only a kid at the time, rather than having to go to Letterkenny. We seem to be going backwards sometimes in some spaces. All right, there was another one here, wasn't there, that I didn't get to. Hi, Greg. What's happened with road design in Donegal? They seem to be narrowing roads and junctions. They need to have a HGV driver on the team. Great to hear you back. Great to be back. Listen, I mean, at the end of the day, it is almost part of policy to narrow roads. It slows people down. That's what I'm being told in any case. Okay, let me see if I can go to... if I can go to Dr. Eileen Doherty. Are you there, Eileen? Eileen, are you there? No.
I am here indeed, yes. I'm trying to unmute myself. How are you?
I am doing good. I'm doing good. Right, okay. So yesterday, a group of defective concrete researchers from Ulster University presented the Oireachtas members with their research in Leinster House at the invitation of Donegal 100% Redress TD Charles Ward. Professor Paul Dunlop, Professor Eileen Doherty, we're speaking to, Professor Karen Kirby met with around 40 TDs and senators, briefing them on the changing science of what's causing the blocks to deteriorate and also the social and mental health impacts of the crisis. We'll speak to others that were present yesterday, Eileen, but I'm just keen to sort of get your... I mean, we know the importance of it, right? Because ignorance can't be a defence if you have people sat in front of you with evidence-based arguments, be it in terms of the science of the blocks or the social and mental health impacts. But what is your takeaway from yesterday's meeting?
Thank you very much, Greg. Yes, so obviously myself, Professor Paul Dunlop, Dr. Karen Kirby and Oisin Keenan, who is a PhD researcher, were invited by Charles Ward TD to present yesterday in the Dáil. The common thread really was just to give an update really on, I suppose, for my, particularly for myself and Paul, on where we are in relation to the defective block scheme. Paul started off by looking at the evolving and review of the IS 465 and the importance of getting that right and stuff. And then I followed on from that then, and I really just gave the audience an update on where we are with the scheme. Particularly, Greg, there is a narrative within government that the scheme is fixed. There's a view that we have all been given 100% redress and that that there was a comprehensive consultation with families to get the scheme right this time. So that is the press. That's what I showed at the start, that that's what the government narrative is saying, but the reality is very, very different. And I presented some of the findings of my research, which shows that loads of stakeholders involved with the scheme are not happy. The scheme isn't working for so many families. It's too difficult and all those things. And I also brought in some of the findings from the Petitions Committee when they came over over a couple of years ago, where objectively they've also agreed that the scheme isn't working. And finally, mine was talking about the fact that based on the current speed of remediation, which is just over two homes a month, we're looking at over 1,500 years before these houses are fixed. There was a lot of shock in the audience about those kind of figures. There is a narrative in the corridors of government that the scheme is actually fixed. And there was a lot of discussion with around that afterwards about how that is a very different reality than what they thought. And then obviously Professor Karen and Oisin talked about the absolute horrific mental health impact this is having on families and children. So it was a very, very useful presentation.
Yeah, absolutely no doubt about it. Professor Paul Dunlop is with us. I'll refer to, get back to you, of course, Eileen, in a moment. Professor Dunlop, as I said, sort of in my introduction to Eileen, you know, ignorance can't be a defence. And from Eileen's testimony there, unbelievably, you know, the penny maybe was landing with some people that this problem is not resolved, that we're a long way from being where we need to be.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think if you live in the counties that are impacted by this and you're on the ground living with it yourself and dealing with families, we know that this is not resolved. And it was clear from the motion that was presented last week by Charles Ward, and it was supported by all the opposition, that all the issues that were highlighted clearly showed that it's not working, but yet the government still voted all of that down. So I think it's also very important as a researcher to share research with policymakers, because one of the things that research does, which is very powerful, is it has a very robust methodology to try and find out actually what's happening on the ground. So we've talked at great length about concrete failure and what the work that we did, that we've shared with government departments, National Standards Authority of Ireland. But it's also good to go and try and talk to all our policymakers who are can make a difference, and who may not know the detail of this because they don't read reports or don't read scientific papers. So yesterday was a chance to go back and try and reiterate it once again why concrete has failed, why it's important for the scheme, why it's important for a nation that's blighted by a defective concrete crisis, but then also to try and get across to them that, you know, the impacts of this is not about just people whinging and moaning. These are really serious mental health impacts that have been rigorously studied now by very good, high quality academics at Ulster University, and the science has been peer reviewed as well too. So it adds, I think, a significant amount of weight to the debate. So that's what yesterday was about. It was about going back down again to share everything that we do at Ulster University to try and make a difference at this crisis. And it's not just hearsay or our opinions, it's robust data.
So how does this add to the discussion if they would be all sitting there waiting, well, we're going to take the guidance from IS 465 and be guided by that? What extra weight or impact might, you know, going down there and giving, you know, the results of extensive research, what does that add, do you think?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I would hope after extensive engagement for 2 years with NSCI, with our team, that this wouldn't be needed, and that they would get the standard and revise it based on the science that was supplied to them. But, you know, we know that from the draft that was published in in July, that sort of that was opened for public consultation at the end of July. We know that the total sulfur levels were set too high for that in the testing protocols. So it's important for them to know this because it's not published yet. And, you know, discussions can happen in the background with the NSAI and the different departments. And my point was really to try and make sure that IS-465 must be correct.
And is it
Otherwise,
important also too that there's some sort of rehabilitation of mica done, if I could put it like that, in that, you know, we need an active housing market here, and I still hear people say, you know, is the mica in that house? You know, we need to get the mica test. It's casual language, and you know, I think it's holding up sales, it's holding up purchases, because do we have a set established level of it? We need to sort of really get the language right.
Well, that's another opinion. I mean, I have consistently been saying, telling people that this is not mica, and I understand the impacts that people perceiving this as being a mica problem is having on the market, because people, as you say, can't sell their homes. So very clearly, anybody who was in that room yesterday were told with very clear language that this is not mica and that we do not have a mica crisis. We have a crisis that's been caused by iron sulfide minerals that are creating internal sulfide attack. Now, we have met with the BPFI, Bank and Payments Federation of Ireland. They have a working group that are looking into conveyancing across Ireland, and we have shared that scientific knowledge with them as well. So they understand that this is also not mica and that they need to develop a scheme around conveyancing that is not based on testing for mica. We need to be able to have a system where people can sell their homes and move on, because it is that is another crisis that has come out of
Are
this.
you confident the review of IS-465 will assist in that?
Well, IS-465 specifically states that it's not to be used for conveyancing. So if that is the case for that, I mean, IS-465 was developed to test defective properties, but it's being used to also test properties that are not defective, and it's having a side problem where people are going through a testing protocol set up not for them.
And
So ultimately, I
I
think.
have seen this. I also have seen this scenario whereby people are using signs about how high or low the mica level is, and it's going to impact almost value because purchasers are probably going to use that list. And I know it's not going to destroy the blocks, but it is kind of high. It's a peculiar.
I deal with it a lot. I get sent a lot of people's reports, which I don't really, I'm not really involved in this housing market thing, but I try and sort of help people if I can and assist. But I know for a fact that that they're setting mica levels at 6% or 7%, and a bank will not lend on a property. Yet we know that there's no iron sulfides and there's no internal sulfide attack, and that property is going to be okay. So, I mean, as scientists, what we did, we have shared, myself, Andreas Lehmann, Chris Brough from Petrolab has also met the BPFI working group, explained what the cause of concrete failure, and they're committed to coming up with a new system for conveyancing for homes. So I'm hoping in the future that this cottage industry that has sprung up in Donegal doing mica tests and percentage of micas, taking samples or one or two samples from one wall in the home, and sort of thinking that's going to be good enough to try and sell a house or to give information for a buyer's security.
I've seen people with the promise of quick turnarounds getting tests that actually offer no information at all, if the
I've seen
truth be
that.
told, in terms. And there are people spending thousands and thousands on this. So actually, it's well worth noting. We're still in the company, of course, of Dr. Eileen Doherty, who I want to go back to. Oisin Keenan has done some important research, and I hope Professor Karen Kirby is with me. Are you there, Karen?
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Thank you for joining me. Can you talk to us about your role in the presentation yesterday and what information you've been gathering?
So my role was to present some of the we've been that's been ongoing for the last couple of years, and I'm joined today, as you know, by my PhD researcher, Oisin Keenan. So this Oisin has dedicated the last 2 years to trying to understand the scale of the mental health impact on people, particularly, I suppose, parents and children as well.
Is that easy to quantify?
We have, I suppose, in our world of work, because we're and psychologists, we use particular methods. The methods are using robust psychometric measures. So we use standardized tools in a survey to gather information on, for example, anxiety, levels of depression. We also examined what we believe. We hypothesized that there may be some trauma symptoms, so we measured PTSD and complex PTSD and suicidality in the sample as well. So we had gathered up to nearly 400 in our sample, and within that survey as well, we asked parents to talk about
Yeah, you're dropping out a little. I'll go to Oisin just momentarily, Karen. Right. I just want, it's not your fault. No, I appreciate your time. I hope this is not an insensitive question, but can you compare what you've seen trend-wise in terms of how this is affecting people compared to other crises that you might have looked at in life, if that makes sense? No, I believe actually I have lost.
Oisin could answer that question.
Yes, I'm going to go to Oisin. It's just Oisin's disappeared a little bit for me. Oisin, talk to me about 2 years dedicated to this.
Yeah. Like Karen was saying, we wanted to sort of quantify the human impact with rigorous science, the same way Paul examined the causes of the crisis. We wanted to see what impact this was having on people's mental health and their lives. So we did a rigorous study, and the first one's been published, and it's shown very elevated rates of all those mental health conditions that Karen highlighted. And they are comparable, like you're saying, to other crises or things like natural disasters, which you mightn't think at first, but a lot of the impacts on people's lives are quite similar. Property damage, losing their homes, the financial and administrative burden. It's just it's happening in slow motion. So we have found the rates are comparable and in line with many other traumatic experiences.
Yeah, and is it I presume it has to be, and you've outlined this, exacerbated by the slow nature of this. And you put it really well there, because it was the two words I was going to use, the slow motion element of it. It's, and the fact, too, that you're trapped in what's causing you the greatest anxiety.
Yeah, exactly. You're living in, it's your home, that's where you are all the time. And yeah, you can't really get out of that situation. So the problem with the slow motion nature of it is that there's less urgency for governments and responses to address it, because it's happening over years and years. But we can see the impacts are causing a lot of distress for people.
What was your sense of the room? Obviously, Oisin, you'd have been very focused in what you were doing, right? But you were present yesterday, weren't you?
Yeah, I was present.
Okay, so what was your sense of you know, those receiving this information perhaps for the first time?
Yeah, they all seemed very receptive and interested. There was several TDs there, a couple from the government, like Charlie McConlogue, and several TDs from counties that were affected, like Mayo and Clare and Limerick. So they did seem very interested, the TDs, and taking photos. And yeah, there was a good response, and seemed a lot of the information that between all our presentations, they didn't know some of it. And yeah, that was the overall goal with Charles Ward, to really just try and highlight the science and hopefully educate just the impact this is having on people.
All right, listen, Oisin, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your work too. It's a huge dedication. We really do appreciate it. Eileen, just talking of some of the reactions there, and I mean locally, the most senior politician we have here would be Minister Charlie McConlogue. You know, following on from the presentation, you know, what was his reaction? What was his, I suppose, does he feel he's well briefed on this? You know, what points was he seeking further clarification on, etc.?
Well, unfortunately, Minister McConlogue didn't stay after the presentations were over. He left immediately. Right. I don't know if he had another appointment or whatever, so he wasn't there. So he didn't engage in the discussion afterwards. But there were other TDs there, Greg, that did. My general sense was that there was a sense that people thought in the room, they thought they knew a lot about the scheme. They thought they knew about, you know, the stuff around the science, like Paul, the protocols. I think they thought they knew that a lot about, you know, we talked about the fact that we are perceived a lot in government, or we're made to believe or be perceived as whingers, as that he's never happy, where we actually presented the reality of the situation, where there are many flaws that still need worked on, not just the science that Paul talked about, but just generally the scheme. The scheme is too difficult. And then the fact, the common thread that ran through all of our presentations were in relation to, for example, the protocol. If they had listened the first time, they wouldn't have said it was mica. Therefore, we wouldn't have been in this mess. If they'd listened in relation to the design of the scheme, if the government had worked with the families on the ground, we wouldn't have had two iterations of the scheme that are still not working. And then the outcome or the outworkings of that are the mental health impacts. So a lot of it was about saying, look, government, it's about time you started listening. It's about time you started working on the ground with the people who actually can provide the insights that you need. Like, one of the things we said was, we don't expect to get everything, obviously, that we want. We're not you know, silly like that, Greg, but we realize that working together is the only way we're going to get a scheme that fits. It's the only way that it's going to work. And
but what's frustrating, Eileen, is and anyone, if it was a private business, if you've got a problem, you fix it. You don't half fix it or part fix it. You want to fix it all, especially if you're using someone else's, when you're using somebody else's money. I mean, that's just basic logic. If you're committing multiple billions, or you say you are, right? The whole idea, presumably, is that you want to make sure it's absolutely perfect, etc. And also then we have to factor in clawbacks in certain areas as well. You've got a guest with you, Professor Dunlop.
Sorry, say it again, Greg.
Have you got someone with you? Who's with you there?
Yeah, Karen. So the Wi-Fi was in the room, so it's better in my...
All right, sorry, Karen. We were losing you there. We appreciate you rejoining us.
Thanks. No, I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
No, it's no problem at all. So just recap then, whilst we have you in such a clear format, then your takeaway from yesterday and the 2 years that's gone into this.
Well, we're very satisfied with the outcomes, I suppose, that we can stand over the data and the findings. But we really think now that has to be taken forward. And we would really like it if we could possibly have a meeting with the Health Committee. Because we also, not only are we sharing findings, yes, we're researchers, but we're also psychologists, and we have an ethical duty to kind of try and the right people who need to hear this need to hear it. So
see,
we need
the thing about it too, Karen, if you look at, say, for instance, when we had the awful Chrysler tragedy, you know, part of the response to that was to put in supports, mental health supports, fantastically, in fairness. If we have a tragedy in a school, the first thing seems to happen as well is that there is support, a system kicks in. The only proof of the pudding really as to how serious this crisis is being taken would be, well, what comes in at a statutory level, what comes in from the HSE or from a government to recognise the trauma and the impact, the potential for suicide in this crisis? That would be the proof of how serious this research will be taken.
Yeah. And I think, particularly with the suicidality rate, you know, people, the rates were 30-35%, and they're a lot higher than our national population statistics. And we've been able to compare that as well using the same tools and same measures. I think that there are some community supports put in place. I mean, I was recently talking to a representative from the National Development Partnership, and they do provide counselling, but it's only six sessions. It's really not enough for what we're seeing. And because we've looked at the rates are quite severe, both for depression, anxiety, and particularly for the complex trauma that we found, and as I said, the suicide rates as well, six sessions will never really be enough. But we also understand the source and the nature of the issue. And it's because people are stuck. They're trapped in the situation that they're in. So in some sense, there's no amount of counselling or therapy is going to relieve that issue. So what we're saying is you must swiftly put people through the scheme.
That's what
we're asking for.
If it was the downgraded homeowners, for example, if they were told, we've reviewed the situation and here's a date whereby such and such will happen, you can live with that. But you can't live, or it's very difficult to live with a purgatory of we're going absolutely nowhere. We're not, there's no progress, there's no nothing. We're not, I don't, you're the psychologist, I think, right? So we're not programmed to deal with sort of uncertainty very, very well.
Exactly. And we were able to, we actually studied those predictors, you know, the mechanisms of suicidality, and we talked about them yesterday. And some of those are things like defeat, hopelessness, a sense of entrapment. So people are trapped in these situations, and they don't see, they see an inescapable, can't see solutions. So we understand that if those are the predictors of things like suicidality, then we also know that, well, remove the sense of defeat, remove the sense of entrapment, allow people a sense of hope. That there is, and the only people that could do that is the current government.
Okay.
That's, and that's really the that is it in a nutshell. That's what we're asking for. And because we've studied the predictors of it, we understand that the reasons why people have such high rates. And so the source, the root of the issue has to be addressed.
Okay. I do have to, I do have to take a, an ad break. I have no choice. Charles, Deputy Charles Wald is waiting. I do have questions for all of you still, but if you need to make off, I understand that as well.
No, we're okay. We
are
can
you
hang
okay? Eileen, are you okay for a moment?
Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah.
Okay. No, because it's such a critical critical. It would be ironic, wouldn't it, if I rushed off on a topic like this when we're trying to get more attention from the state on it. So I'll be back with more and the very patient Charles Wald after this quick break. Okay, we're reviewing a significant situation in the Dáil yesterday whereby a group of defective concrete researchers from Ulster University presented Oireachtas members with their research based on science, the blocks, etc., but also the social and mental health impacts of the crisis. They were all there at the invite of 100% Redress Deputy Charles Wald, who's with us as well. Good morning, Charles. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, listeners. How are you?
Good, good, good. I suppose really the motivation for this obviously is to keep the issue on the agenda, but actually to sit people down and make them face facts.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. What it is, yesterday was a perfect blend of the science. So first of all, you're explaining to people what exactly is going on, and then you're showing them the mental devastation this humanitarian crisis has caused.
Is it a little bit regrettable that maybe this presentation didn't happen before your motion last week?
I don't know. Look, everything's about timing, Greg. And look, we had this booked, and I think
it's not a criticism. I'm just saying in an ideal world.
Yeah, no, I know. I got the opposition on board. I knew the government parties weren't going to change their mind anyway. They're not going to do anything right now, currently, the way things are, until we get the review of IS-465. But I don't think if we had it a week before, it would have influenced the government. It would have just probably been the same. But
how would you assess the reaction from the Donegal government deputies to yesterday? I mean, do you think anything was learned?
Well, look, listen, Charlie stayed for a bit and then left, but the rest of them, no. And Pat was there. Pat, I told him in no certain terms that, you know, we have a humanitarian crisis here. This is a humanitarian crisis that's going on in Donegal. And you have to tell the government, you have to make them listen, because we're not going away, we're not going anywhere. You have to listen.
Eileen, I can't think of any other campaign or issue or anything at all whereby the people affected by this have done so much work, so much proper high-end research in relation to this. Arguably the work that, you know, the state should have kicked in with themselves right at the very get-go, considering that public money and the health of the public was at stake here. Can you think of any other scenario where we've got so much, you know, real testimony, the academic stuff, which is not a very academic way of putting it, to back it up. But do you get where I'm coming from, Eileen?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's sad that, like Paul mentioned it earlier, it's sad that we are still here. I mean, in 2020, when the first scheme was launched, myself and Anne Owen stepped down because we had spent very intense 6 years, you know, kind of at the sort of at the forefront of the campaigning. And we really thought at that stage that we could hand it over and it was in safe hands and the local authority was going to look after it and so on. But, you know, we find ourselves here and we're 5 years later and we've had to take a different trajectory. Like, I've spoken to Paul and Karen and others about this. You know, we felt like we were shouting from the sidelines for quite a number of years. And then we realized that we have to embed what we say in science. So that's why we've moved in a different direction, that we have to say, look, you can't dispute. Karen's using these instruments that are validated. Paul's using these tools. You know, we're all doing it from a very rigorous research point of view. So that when we do stand on the dole like yesterday, they can't say, well, this is just anecdotal and this is just Eileen whinging, or these are facts. We're standing there now and we're saying, based on fact and research that we are actually undertaking, you need to do something. And I suppose the key thing for me is, at the end of the discussion yesterday, the question is now back to the representatives in the room. You now understand this crisis is still ongoing. You know, we're looking at Karen and Oisin said yesterday, as at a transgenerational or intergenerational mental health impact. You know, we're decades, we're looking at the impacts on children and families. You know, what are you going to do? How many times do we have to keep saying the same thing? And also trying to make sure that they understand that this narrative of we have been given 100% redress, that everything is in hand, isn't the case.
Well, it's gaslighting, and that word's overused nowadays, but that's what it must feel like. Eileen, thank you so much for so much of your time. Dr. Eileen Doherty there. I want to come back to you, Karen Kirby, and I'll wrap it up with the deputy. I get a feeling with this crisis is that it'll only land in a generation or two when people will look back and sort of what the situation was, what we actually knew, right? Not stuff that we've learned from sort of backward looking, but what we actually knew in that time and how we reacted. And I think if I were an elected rep, I'd want to be on the right side of history on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Just as Eileen was saying, we can, with some prediction, because the rates are so high, and because we have surveyed the got information about the children as well, and the rates for the children are actually quite high as well. There's a lot of emotional problems, peer issues, behavioural issues. And we use the strength and difficulty questionnaire to assess that. We can kind of predict from that there's going to be lots of systemic, so family and systemic distress. So we refer to it as a chronic toxic stress. So if it goes on over a long period of time, that's why you see some of those high rates of the complex trauma. But that, we know, can contribute to the transgenerational impact. So parents are trying to raise their children whilst they're in the middle of this terrible distress. The children are trying to deal with that as well. There's interpersonal relationships can be strained. That all has a knock-on effect on the child.
In real terms, then, and just as an example, if there's a 7-6, this is one of those things where we can't, as parents, protect our children from because it's ever-present, it's around them. Is this the type that's a 6-7-8-year-old? Now, we need to be careful that they could have relationship issues in the future, maybe dependency, psychological issues. Is that what we talk about, the potential impact as people mature, or is that too great a generalisation?
Well, it's not necessarily, and the, you know, we don't know and what's happening exactly and inside everybody's homes, you know, the level of nuanced details. But I can tell you one story that really made me particularly annoyed. And this is where some children who are aware that their parents are experiencing financial distress, parents have saved money, for example, for them to go to university. But the child has decided that I'm not going to go where I want to go. I'm going to stay. I'm not going to go because I don't understand my parents can't afford it. So there's knock-on effects and various different. There's so many levels. There's so many moving plates of how it's impacting, you know, children. So, but I do think that when we compare it to other natural disasters, and we have done that, we've compared the rates, then we can make some algorithms and some predictions that this will continue and it will affect children later on and families.
Okay.
I'll just say one last thing. Please, we do think that we have to try and speak to the Health Committee about it.
I think that's and hopefully that can be facilitated. Professor Karen Kirby, lovely to speak to you. And Professor Paul Dunlop, always a pleasure, both of you. Thanks very much indeed. What happens next, Deputy Ward, then? I mean, you know, like, as I say, we'll be told that this is a scheme that has been designed, that it can adapt, it will be adapted. We've seen the cap increased recently. You know, we're waiting on IS-465, the review of that. If it shows that everything needs to be tossed and the foundations come out, that's what we'll do. The government will say, well, we're doing all we can. We're ticking all the boxes. The scheme is there. We can't make people sign up to it.
Well, that's what we're facing. What we're facing right here and right now is there has been no cap. There's people waiting for a retrospective payment. They've been waiting months and months and months, actually in financial peril, most of them, because this scheme does not work. They're out of pocket. All we're made to do is wait and wait and wait. And this is what the government do. They try and run down the clock, constantly making you wait. And then we have to see what the devil is going to be in the detail with IS-465. I think we need to say this too, is we have our representatives and we are doing a job up here to try and highlight what's going on. But on the ground, we have potentially 25,000 homes affected. And our local councillors need to acknowledge this. They need to realise it's an emergency. We have a defective concrete committee that should have, frankly, have a lot more power than it does have. And I think that needs to be looked at, because what we've got coming down the line is a homelessness crisis and a mental health crisis. And we were talking about the study there. This has been going on for 14 years. There's people now that were in the middle of this when this happened. They are now adults, and they're traumatized by this.
To mention those that are no longer with us.
Yes. And Greg, can I just say something before I go? When I was campaigning on this, I was down the country, down south of the country. I was on another radio station where I said this, and I was asked to apologize for my comments, and I refused to apologize. There's been people that have taken their life, and their names will never be forgotten.
No, and I can, if I was with you, back you up on that, because I know it personally myself as well. Not personally in the way that I know the people personally, but I know very, very much so. Thanks very much for that. That's Deputy Charles Ward, Professor Karen Kirby, Oisin Keenan, Professor Paul Dunlop, and Dr. Eileen Doherty.